And the
I drove.
Kol HaKavod, the Watsons are in America. They have a wedding. And the ranks are thin here, no matter which way you look at it this year. And the Kabbalah Tov. But we have many, many listening. So Baruch Hashem, I just have to have a Rebbe's vision. And I see thousands in front of me. A little, Charlie, a little Ruach HaKodesh. You got it? Aye. Where does it come? But what can I tell you? Mokom hinichlo avatavl kadeh about the Gemara in Cholent Afsayim. Okay, today we in the Baruch Hashem, we had quite a shiur yesterday. You'll hear about the material, very powerful, leaves you thinking. Achareb Moshe, Achieza, Mishnalachad, Malam Lahoi, Baruch Hashem. Okay, today is February 6, 2017. It's Monday morning here in Yerushalayim HaKodesh. If I'm not mistaken, this is Yud Shvat. So we're dealing with the Yud side of the 6th Rebbe. And this is when the 7th Rebbe, one year later, he officially accepted the kingship, let's say, royalty. Welcome to everybody. Seats, there are plenty of seats. You have to schlep seats. Now, people have sent me some very interesting pictures of Rav Hutna. So there's one that I showed you. This one is from Slabodka or Chevron with a group of Slabodka students. And there's Rav Hutna in the middle. He was an ace. And you notice the way they're dressed. This is Rav Hutna in Chaim Berlin from a yearbook that the students put out in their chemistry laboratory. You see the young Rav Hutna, and there's the chemistry laboratory. But the one that's worth everything has to be 68, I would say. There's Rav Hutna. I don't know who the Rav is in the middle. And on the side, partial, who do you see there? Rav Shlomo Goren. That's when Rav Shlomo Goren visited America and walked around in the general of a in the uniform of a general in the IDF, and I'll never forget it. So, and later that helped me when I was on the encyclopedia and I had to edit, or I wrote the article on Rav Goren, so I told him right away, and right away he broke into English. You follow? He already knew an American, used his English on me, and he prepared the article. Then I met him at the Kotel. I asked him shilas. Then later in life with Russian. Do you remember Yitzchak? I went to see him with the whole question of going to shul on Shabbos with the metro, with the pinning on the ticket, and we had a relationship. All right. Now let's today is very important. So we see we're talking about Jackie. We're talking about Rav Shlomo Goren. And we see that this was a man whose personality was volatile. He never stopped changing, he never stopped growing, he never stopped seeking, he never stopped searching. And what's fascinating is, he was a Rosh Yeshiva who gave Shegur and Shasim Paiskim, and as time marched on, his thrust became much more Machshava, Maharal, the Maimarim, overtook the Shayurim that he was giving in Shasim Paiskim. A Talmud of mine in America, most reliable Talmud, Aryeh, wrote to me, I once heard from Rabbi Ganak that the Rav told Rav Hutna, paraphrasing the Gemara, Malach Eitzel Agada, Klach Eitzel Negoyim Va'ahalach. And that's the famous Gemara, who they told off, Rabbi Akiva, was it that? What are you getting involved with Agada? You have to deal with the halachot, the most difficult halachot. And it was the Rav saying to Rav Hutna, you know Shasim Paiskim, you're a tremendous Rosh Yeshiva. What are you getting involved with the Machshava and Maharal? So it's an interesting comment. An interesting comment that reveals the Rav as well and supports my thesis on the Rav that he remained fundamentally. His entire gestalt was that of the Rosh Yeshiva, that of Brisk, that of Elijah. Aye, he played with Agada, he played with philosophy, but that was a sideshow by the Rav. With Rav Hutna, it became the main circus. The sideshow was Shas and Paiskim. The main thrust of Rav Hutner was the Maimarim. And you know what the Pachad Yitzchak is all about? It is represents these Maimarim, these talks that Rav Hutner gave that were so unique. When they were originally published, they were published anonymously. And I said last week, that's it is so true that why were they published anonymously? So his students who were close to Rav Hutner say, Rav Hutner wanted to give you a message. If you weren't there in person to hear the talk, you couldn't fully appreciate it. And I love that description, the way he walked in, the way he sat down, the way he took off his glasses. It was an entire performance. And in Hachinami, there's a lot of truth to it. As I said last week, there's no way we can adequately describe the Yahrzeit Shiur of the Rav. There's no way that you can describe a Fabrenian at 770 if you weren't there. Yeah, you can describe it, you can use words, sentences, but the emotion, the feeling, when we walked out of the Yahrzeit Shiur, we felt we had participated in Matan Torah. That's what it's all about. And that you can't put into writing. It's just impossible. I remember I had a Talmud, the Rabbi Fuchs, Rabbi Moshe Fuchs today. Maybe some of you know him. He's no youngster, obviously. He was my Talmud the early 60s. So his father was a survivor. And whenever he meets me, he reminds me how his father and I, after the Yahrzeit Shiur, we were riding back on the 36 bus. I was on Washington, and his father was further east and had a shul. And he reminds me how his father and I were talking about the shiur, and we just were, our eyes were a shine. It was Maimer HaSinai. All right, so there's a lot of truth to it. What's interesting too, and here's why I pick up, over the years, Rav Hutner's position changed, which again leads us to the whole question, is a Rebbe allowed to shift gears? And we can, it's not for now, I've lectured on this, brought my Mari Chazal, I have a lot to say. But there's no question, Rakefet you can view as, wow, what an admirable figure, or what a disgrace. On one hand, people who know me say, Rebbe, you haven't changed a bit. 60 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years, haven't changed. That's correct. I have to tell you, my hashkafas have remained very static since I turned 18, in the Rav Shiur, I would say. Now, is that a compliment or not a compliment? You understand? Think about it. It's not black and white. There were two fellas in the Kollel years ago came to me and told me off why I didn't remain in America. These fellas were a little bit unhappy with the so-called swing to the right in YU. And they said, had you remained, you would be a dominant personality in summer with a kippah srugah and a certain broadness, which we don't have in YU today. There's no real Talmud of the Rav teaching us today. And these are very capable young people from fine homes. Two of them, I think one of the two remained in Israel, that's for sure. I don't know about the other one. And I told them, you're dummies. Had I remained in America, I would have been like everyone else. I would have gone along with the crowd. I would have gone this whole a swing to the black and dressing a certain way and that whole attitude and each one yesing the other one. I said, Baruch Hashem, I went in Aliyah and I became what I became and I remained in America. You guys wouldn't even be talking to me. I'd be one of the Rebbeim and Chayrim. Ah, they listen, Dov, you got to be a little older to appreciate that answer. But Rav Hutner, one thing is for sure. The Rav, I can tell you, the Rav I knew remained the Rav. He didn't shift gears. All right? Rav Moshe Feinstein, outside of the Geirut, he never shifted gears. As far as I can tell, with all his tshuva, Rav Moshe never shifted gears. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, you know all the names you'll give. Rav Aaron Cutler, but Rav Yitzchak Hutner shifted gears. Here was a man, took down the picture of Rav Kook, put up the Chazon Eish's picture in his sukkah. Here was a man who was so close to the Soloveitchik family when Rav Aaron Lichtenstein got married. Now mind you, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is Talmud. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's uncle-to-be, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Yitzchak Hutner's Talmud and the next in command from Chaim Berlin for many decades. Moriva Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. And that day, Rav Hudna, I'll never forget it, Rav Hudna, everyone said he set out for the wedding. He left Chaim Berlin. His Gaboyim were with him. Everyone got the impression he was going to the wedding in Boston. And one thing, he never showed up at the wedding. So it shows you, this is Rav Hudna. Now, what's amazing is, as independent as he was, and Yonatan, and with all the shifting of gears, two people he absolutely stood in awe of. And as much as Rav Hudna had a self-presence and understood who he was, these people, he bent his head, he was Makabel Alav Ol Malchut Shamayim. And who were these two people? Rav Aaron Cutler and the Sachmur of Rav Yoel Teitelbaum. Now, Rav Aaron Cutler, and this is something you have to understand. I knew Rav Aaron, and I learned with Rav Aaron, and I spoke in learning with Rav Aaron, and I'm probably the only one that can boast. I even told the Rosh Yeshiva Roth, I'll never forget our conversation, where I tried to convince him that Mizrahi and Bnei Akiva were the right Hashafa, and Rav Aaron said to me, no, Nishtengansen, they didn't have the total right Hashkafa. And I knew Rav Aaron was the Arisha B'chabura. The Rav, as distance as he was from Rav Aaron in Hashkafa in the United States, remember, when he had the Shaila that was asked of him to get the Jews out of Cuba on Yom Kippur, Castro was willing to let them leave, who did he consult with? He consulted with Rav Aaron Cutler. You have to understand that Rav Aaron Cutler was Shichmo Lamala Mikol Ha'am. All right? Rav Hudna ultimately would never do anything that Rav Cutler objected to. He bowed before him. And the greatest example, which is documented, is the attempt to build the college in Brooklyn in the late 40s. Professor Shaya Lyman has written about it, documented it. You read Willie Helmreich's book, Professor Helmreich's book. The documents are all in that book as well. The Yeshiva World. Are you familiar with it? It came out in the 80s. I'll quote it, but not yet. It's a fabulous volume. I played a role in that volume. He thanks me in the introduction. I'll never forget. It was the first book he published, and he was so worried. Well, the first book he published on the Jewish topic, and Willy Helmreich, who was an MTA graduate, it was a year or two before me. I knew him from MTA, but I had already published on Revel and Silva, so I remember I went through the manuscript, I made some emendations, ideas, and he gives you the whole story too. And Mr. Shraga Feigelman, the Lovage, I mean, you have no idea, the whole story of American Orthodoxy could have been different, might have been different. Imagine you build a college, students go to college, there's no anti-college pressure, a college run by Jews, for Jews, but not in the same building as the yeshiva. It would be a separate institution for all the yeshiva, basically in Brooklyn, and they got the charter. They already got the charter. You can see pictures of the charter. And Rav Aaron Cutler was hysterical, gave a clap, and Rav Hudna backed off. And now just think of that, Derech Eretz. The Satmaruv, Rav Hudna became a Satmarian in the 70s, what he published about the Holocaust. Unbelievable. The Satmaruv's theory, word by word, that the Zionists caused the Holocaust. The Zionists caused the Holocaust. It was a talk he gave at the Agudat Yisrael convention. And I have to say, Agudat Yisrael, if you pick up at the end of yesterday's shiur that I gave, it's actually happening with Agudat Yisrael. What I described is going to happen and happening in Israel. Agudat Yisrael, the new generation, already has made its peace with the Western world. They're at home in the Western world. The last Agudat convention, you suddenly heard problems discussed that they never raised before. It was always swept under the carpet. The sexual problems, etc. Many more.
In America.
No, here in Israel, there's no good at Israel. It's split. There's the Chassidim, etc. Rav Shach split it three different ways. And you'll never have unity again. But for the sake of the election, to pass the cutoff point, Achuz Chasima. How do you say that in English? I don't even know. Achuz Chasima. To pass the cutoff point, they unite, because otherwise they won't be able to get into the Knesset.
Degel
Torah becomes part of Agudat Yisrael. Shas remains separate, but I don't know how much longer that will survive. The infighting in Shas today is beyond words, and Shas has many people who have no concept what Yiddishkeit is, their beards and whatnot, and then they let the Reform do what they want, the Conserve let the stores be open Shabbos. I mean, what's going on with Derry now, I don't know how the Svadik Rabbonim don't declare, don't yell and shout and force him to imagine. He can close down all the stores on Shabbos. In 1 second flat, the power's in his hands. And 180 stores remain open in Tel Aviv and many stores in Yerushalayim. It's a terrible situation.
It's a political decision.
Political or halachic? You're a Jew or you're not a Jew? Throw that politics out. Torah, Shabbos.
Yeah, but if you force that on the people in Tel Aviv, that's not the...
Don't believe that from today
Western
to tomorrow.
No, it'll create a backlash.
It won't create a backlash. Shabbos is Shabbos. Let God worry about the backlash. We become murderers. If we're not a Jewish state, we have no right to this land. We murdered Arabs. Chinam. You understand? Our own boys fell chinam. If we're a Jewish state, it's a different... Remember what I told you about Benigal? Okay, anyway, it doesn't matter. So he took on Rabbi Yoel. Now Rabbi Yoel talked about Rabbi Yoelish. We have to understand. You're dealing here with the most extreme element of Torah in the Western scene. You're dealing here with Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum. And he was a man who was saved, I mean, by the Jewish agency, the Kastner train. You're talking the Jewish agency saved him. And nevertheless, and the harm he caused Agudat Yisrael, Rabbi Aaron Cutler was furious. Why? Very simple. He wouldn't let them vote in the elections. What Alex just mentioned, political power, the more seats you had in the Knesset, the more power you had. If Agudat Yisrael would have had two more seats, it would have meant millions and millions of lira and shekel afterwards for Chinuch Atzmai. Because of Rabbi Yoelish, they never got those two extra seats. So many Jews didn't vote. I mean, this is idiocy. I once told someone off, he's mad at me until today, a big Talmud Chacham, a big Yirei Shemayim, but also someone that can't handle criticism. And I once said to him, he was told his children not to vote in the election. No one's worthy of our vote. I said, that's the worst education you can give children. Because what you're telling them is we shouldn't be living in the real world. We live in the real world. Al bal kachenu, we live in the real world. I don't say Bayit Yehudi is ideal. I have my problems, but when I go to vote, I vote Bayit Yehudi. I voted Mizrahi from the day I came in Aliyah. My wife used to vote for Mayor Kahana. Every election we'd have a battle. I tell her, you're wasting your vote. No, I'm entitled to make a statement. Okay.
She's
smarter than her husband is not even a shaila. That is an open gemara. Being the attainer of the nashim.
Yeah, Rebbe, you always quote that. And you don't quote the other.
I'm entitled to quote what I want. Chazal give you many different viewpoints. That reflects many different personalities.
Tara, and they also have weaker dot. That's what it says.
I have my youngest daughter.
I'm afraid ours is
No, Chazal allow for selective quoting because people think differently. Eilu v'eilu divrei Elokim chai. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Take your choice. My wife is smarter than me, absolutely. Let me tell you a great word here. So, and Rabbi Yoelish, with all that extremism, Professor Rothkopf doesn't remember someone gave him a gift for Yom Moshe. He was going, leaving Israel, gives me a gift for Yom Moshe. I took that, I robbed it from him. I have it until today. I know the Yom Moshe by heart, by the Satmurud. Do you remember it was your copy? I have it until today. I robbed it from you. I said, you cannot take this book to Chutz Laaretz. In Israel, fine, read it, be a Satmar, as long as you live here. But in Chutz Laaretz, by the way, Lab Chabad just published by Yoel Cohen, the biggest Chabadnik alive, he published a fabulous response to the Yom Moshe. But they asked Rav Huttner, and listen, and this is on page 34 in Hillel Goldberg's article, They asked Rav Huttner, how can it be someone like you who studied with Rav Kook, studied in Chevron, and you're a member of the Moetzet Gedolei Torah of Agudat Yisrael, and you became a Satma? And he answered, the Satma Ruv, he represents yesteryear. We don't have that anymore. When you have a living example of what Torah was about, you have to give cover. And he said, and he brought a medrash. What is the medrash? Noach. Noach had said they had to feed the animals in the ark. So the medrash says the lions got mad at him and bit him. And the Rav Huttner asked, why did the lions bite him? All right, he was late in feeding the lions. But Atagei Kach, the man is keeping you alive. The man is your source of sustenance. Ah, but the lions represent royalty. These are special animals. And you have to know how to treat them. And the Satmar Ruv is a lion of yesteryear. Now, something else. Following the thinking of the Satmar Ruv and yesteryear, I'll go a little bit further with Rav Huttner's thinking. There was a gradual development here. And Yonatan, you'll be very happy with what I'm about to say, because you're part of the new crowd in YU. Rav Huttner, here he was clean-shaven. Kutzuk Kleider, you know, it's short clothes, modern, westernized. Speaking English, a Rebbe in RJJ. Afterwards, Chaim Berlin, and he moves right, close, Bekisha, a shtickle, a strimel on Shabbos, and he reached a simple conclusion, and think about it. We saw graduates of Yeshivas from Eskolchanan, what you call YU, Chaim Berlin, RJJ, Peiru Vadas, fine, good, conservative, and reform rabbis. It's interesting. I never saw a graduate of Chabad or Satma or Sfat Emet of Gur. Never saw them become conservative reform rabbis. Did you ever see a conservative rabbi wearing a bekesha, wearing a strimel on Shabbos? You see, there's something to be said for keeping dress and being separate. As Rakefer has said, for decades, the minute you dress black and white, you become a chassid. There's no literature world today. Everyone is a chassid. My friend Barry Liebman went to a wedding. A YU wedding. He came back, he was shaking. He says to me, Aaron, hundreds of fellas there with black hats, all YU students. This never was in our time. But there's something to it. Baruch Hashem. Jackie, don't get upset, but next time, program it to play HaTikva. If it's going to ring during the Shia, it has to play HaTikva. And in Australia, Dafka, Gutnik, Yesla Gutnik, when it went off, I made that comment, and I see, you know, Kabbatikim don't sing HaTikva. So that's when my Yetzirah got the worst of me. And in front of 300-400 people, I said, Yesla, do you say Matovu in the morning? Of course. Who wrote Matovu? Bill of Marusha. I can tell you, Ingbam, the only one in this world today that had a direct connection with Naftali Hertz Ingba. He was a Shomer Shabbos. Crazy? Absolutely. A genius? Absolutely. A Makubal? Absolutely. Off the wall? Absolutely. But not worse than Bilam Harasha. A lot better, I believe. My connection? My sisterhood. Herbie will tell you what Maplewood was when I came there in 1962. The treasurer of my sisterhood was Ingba's niece. Her mother, he was a lush. She used to visit him in the hospital, and under her skirt, she tied in a bottle of whiskey they shouldn't see when she walked into the hospital. Had a direct connection with Naftali Hertz Ingba. So you see, Rav Chutna, there was a lot of seichel to what was happening. When he talks about a lion, yesteryears, the Hasidic thrust, and Einach Hinami, every survey, every memoir literature of the Holocaust, Hasidim came out of it. Anyone who went through the Holocaust, you didn't come out of it the same. Either you came out of it frumma, I mean, modela kadosh baruch hu that I survived, miracles of miracles, or you came out of it angry at God. And Chassidim had a much higher percentage of people who remained frum. Litvakin fell by the wayside. It's interesting. So there's something to be said. It's more than just the clothes. There's the Chassidic emotion. In other words, a Litvak lacks emotion. A Chassid, as much as he was angry at God, you read the memoir literature, read Ilan Weisel, read endless memoir literature, but somehow you had to come back. You had to find yourself. That documentary on Borough Park, it's already many years ago, what was it? Dam's documentary, what was it, 1990? A People Apart, I think it's called.
A Life
Apart. A Life Apart, a fabulous documentary. So the person who sponsored Katz, I believe was the name, is no longer alive. So he tells the story how he came out of the Holocaust. It's a fabulous story. It's real. And he was mad at God, angry at God. Chassidish akin, what he went through was a duch gemach, threw it all away. Then in the DP camps, he met this woman who's about, and they married. And she becomes pregnant. And she says to him, you see how women have more seichel. She says to him, what, are you going to raise our kids to be goyim and give Hitler another victory? No, we have to go back to what we were. No, his wife said, he went back. Shabbos, kashrut, sent the kids to yeshiva. Some of them are MTA graduates or BTA graduates. And the kids all went back to their youth. They became Chassidim. And there's a beautiful scene there with the children, Hanukkah, dancing with their father. And everyone has beard and peyus and langa begodim. And the father is an upgesherina like an American, like Rakefet. And the kids say to down to the camera, when we look at our father, we see him with beard and peyus like he was in his youth. That's a very deep commentary. And that's what Rav Yitzchak Kuchner understood it. And I'll make another comment on the film. I'm moving sideways in parentheses, but it's a deep comment. You look at the grandchildren, the American kids born and raised. They don't know the story. They don't care about the story. They don't know about the Holocaust. They just know this is the way to be. They're not even interested what their grandparents went through. Do you know that we had the same thing here in Israel? Those of us involved in Russian Jewry and working and being mice and nefesh, and then ultimately some of the most famous names finally come to Israel. Yuli Khashirovsky. You don't start to understand who Yuli Khashirovsky was. He fell building a sukkah, fell off the ladder and died a few years ago. So sad. So Yuli Khashirovsky, he was the man that the Mossad, imagine all this went on, he never knew it was the Mossad. He knew it was something happening, people, that it's millions of dollars went through his hands to arrange the fence of prisoners of Zion. He was totally trustworthy. There's a picture in the Mossad book of Yuli and I standing in the snow. I'm going to publish it in the next volume of Rakafet Aharon, where we're standing in the snow. I'm exchanging all the messages, but we're standing in the park, deep in snow, where there are no listening devices. So Yuli gets to Israel, and he has a son here. Kid grows up here. And when he was here already 25 years, they asked him, or 20 years, does your son, who's a teenager, does he know anything about what you went through? He says, no. That's the way it should be. Life has to move on. It's a very powerful thought. End the parentheses. But coming back now coming back to Rav Chutna, I want to say a Devar Torah I picked up. In Yonah Diyoma, the Jews are leaving Egypt, V'shala Yisham Yishchantah Migeret Beitah Kli Kesef Kli Zav Usmalot, and clothes you have to take out of the Egyptians. You work the slaves for 200 years, they have to pay you for what they did to you. Servitude. Take what you want, God tells them. And when it comes to the clothes, V'shamtem al b'neichem v'al b'noteichem v'nitzaltem et Mitzrayim. And you should put the clothes on your daughters and sons. So the Shin of a Rav, you know who the Shin of a Rav is? Rav Chaim Halbishtam, the son's a Rav's son, Rav Shin, the Shin of Rav Chetzkel Halbishtam. They say he was as big as his father. People still speak of awe when they mention the Shin of a Rav. So the Shin of a Rav asked a good question. The jewelry, the gold, the silver you take out, you left Egypt, you're using it. But the clothes, the Torah commands you, put it on your children. Dov, what does that mean? Why can't you wear the clothes? So the Shin of a Rav says, because the Jews always had to wear different clothes. What does the Medrash say? One of the four skliyot they had, Shelo Shinu et Malbusham. They didn't change their clothes in Egypt. They wore Jewish clothes. Whatever the clothes was, Bekishes, Bikipad, Strimels, they wore Jewish clothes. Now, you took out Goyish clothes. You have to remodel the clothes into Jewish clothes. When you remodel clothes, you always lose or it becomes smaller. Part of the material disappears. So that's why the Chumash says the clothes, when you remodel, you'll put on the children. That's Rav Yitzchak Chutna. And those were the two people he worshipped. Okay. Finally, this sailing towards the end of Hillel Goldberg's very insightful article. And here, see, no one achieves everything in life. This is Ein Bayit. That doesn't have problems. They're saying, but man, that doesn't have problems. No one achieves everything. It's part of the, I would say it's ontological. Once Adam and Chava sin, the human being will never achieve total happiness. There's always a fly in the ointment.
Well, until Mashiach.
No, but say, we're talking now in regular. You take Reb Moshe Feinstein. Never. His son-in-law died so young. What happened to the family afterwards? It's a classic example. I don't want to come close to home, but I know another gadol shebegadolim that his son never married, and he cried. He said, "My Zayda raised the Rosh Yeshiva, my father raised the Rosh Yeshiva, and I didn't raise the Rosh Yeshiva." And his son is a gon adir, but he's multifaceted, etc. He never married. Each one has their peckle. That's part of life. We can't avoid it. We are humans. Rav Chutna always suffered that he left Eretz Yisrael. I'll show you documents, his love for Eretz Yisrael, the way he was able to express it. And he couldn't cut himself off entirely. All of you know, coming back from a visit to Eretz Yisrael, 1970, I believe the year was, the planes were hijacked that day. He wound up in Jordan. His wife, I believe his children were with him. It was a horrendous experience. How they got out of it alive is Mamish Nisei Nisim. As you know, Hussein's troops fought a pitched battle with the hijackers, and many were killed, but not one hijacked Jew was injured. And you have to give credit to King Hussein. There was a certain streak in him of deep humaneness, and maybe even, I would say, an appreciation and love for the Jewish people. He was a unique individual. Could be, and I'm saying this, and I'll be happy to hear a comment from a Talmud of Rav Hutna. Could be he took the fact that he was hijacked, and with miracles he was part of Kitfei Yad of his, they claim, that he never got back. Part of it did come back, part of it the terrorist destroyed. Could be he took it as a siman min shamayim, you were a traitor towards Eretz Yisrael. And there's no question, the last 10 years of his life, his greatest dream, his greatest goal, was to build a presence in Eretz Yisrael. Those 10 years, when did you study in Chaim Berlin? Was it this? So it's 68? So a little bit before. The 70s, he was going back and forth. He was building the kollel here. He had the ground, he was raising money, he had the money. He was no longer at peace in the United States. And he said openly, the Gemara in Bracha Daf Hei, Amud Aleph, Eretz Yisrael miknet b'yisurim. Eretz Yisrael, you gain, you have to sacrifice. I get very upset when people tell me, like, people come, life is hard here. Yeah, they're talking to the wrong person. I came in 69 and I said goodbye to America when Ellie, Professor Rothkopf, went to see me off at the pier. I never thought I'd see America again. It was a total break. I came with $13,000. It was the money that was not mortgaged. In other words, the mortgage had to be paid off when the house was sold, and I was left with $13,000 in cash. All right, $13,000 was not $13,000 today. Today it's meaningless. Then it was a sum. I was bought the apartment. That was the down payment. I got a mortgage. And we survived the Yom Kippur War. You have no idea what life was like here after the Yom Kippur War. And I was on the books. Everyone was black money, but I was had two full jobs, one at Nechala, one at Gold BMT, Jewish agency check, State of Israel check. And you had no money. Everything was taxed away or war loans. We were lucky to be alive. I was here, remember, I was here 4 years when the Yom Kippur War broke out. Two of the Madrichim from BMT. Two of the Madrichim. How old was BMT? How many Madrichim had we had? Two never came back. Two never came back. Saril Birnbaum and the Stern. I forget Stern's first name. Hashem Yikom Damo. Two never came back. And neighbors, I remember the Kohen from South Africa and old Rivka used to give Birchat Kohanim. He never came back. Oh, it was unbelievable. What could he be alive? So you saw him. Money. We were American people who, I didn't buy a stitch of new clothes. I'll always remember Rabbi Albert, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, the only Tulu suits I ever saw in 1970 and 1980, had someone in his congregation in Sunnyside, Queens, who was in the clothing business. He brought me two suits. One was brown and one was blue, as I recall. Those were the only two new suits I ever saw for maybe 30 years. All right, Baruch Hashem. So Rav Hutna said, talks about himself. He says, until now, when I was in Israel, I didn't suffer. Everything was great. Everything was wonderful. I was young and I had great rebellion, but I never acquired a share in the land because I didn't suffer. In the 70s, he was suffering. First of all, what happened in Jordan. And then building the kollel here and trying to keep his eye on what was going on in New York. It was an impossible situation. And Hillel Goldberg says, "And entrapped in a sapping lawsuit over rights to a yeshiva." Now, I don't know exactly what he means. And if anyone is listening, please inform me. From what I know, and I'll come to it and document it, there was a big machloket over who should succeed Rav Hutna in New York. That is true. And I'll give you details, but not yet. But what does it mean, rights to a yeshiva? If that was the machlokes, then I know about it. But if there was something else, I have not encountered it. anywhere. And Hillel Goldberg sends off the article. He says, yes, it's very difficult to assess this last decade. It's another factor, too. When you're young, you think you're going to live forever. Time does not pressure you. When you reach Rav Huttner's age, that's the last decade of your life, you have to start rushing. You don't have an endless tomorrow. And one thing you know, when you rush, particularly in Israel, you don't accomplish. No one has ever built a building here and told you it'll be ready by Erev Pesach. You're lucky if you can move in Erev Sukkot. Generally speaking, count on Matan Torah, the Shavuot afterwards. Okay? So, you know, Israel, it's a lot is being built. People who have been here 10 years ago come back and they faint when they see all that's been built and what's going on. But everything goes Pamelech. Slowly, reasons why. It's not simple. How many Jews do we have who want to be laborers, who want to build buildings, who want to stand on scaffolds? It's a real problem. Mecca Sarad started a program years ago to try to get young people involved in the building industry. They succeeded, but only on a very small level. I have a kablan, and he repairs in our apartment or in the building. He's got a big job in the building. We're putting up a new fence on the roof. He's a Noah, he's a yeshiva graduate. He's a tzioni dati in the full sense of the word. He only uses Jewish workers. You give them a glass of soda to drink while they're working. They make a bracha, b'shem u'malchut with kavana. It's a pleasure to deal with him. Itama Kohen. He lives out in the Shomron. But how many Jews, where do you get workers, and then the difficulties and the sabotage and all that goes with it, I don't have to elaborate. So you see, Rav Huttner's last decade, it wasn't with great lasting success. He never achieved what he achieved in America, in the state of Israel. I love Hillel Goldberg's conclusion. Building can be rushed, natural seeding cannot. It must proceed in its own time. Perhaps we simply do not know what Rabbi Huttner was attempting. Perhaps he was not granted the time to husband a last dialectic. As Maimonides said of God, as Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, a colleague of Rabbi Huttner, said of the altar of Slabodka, so may we say of Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner himself, quote, to know him, one would have to be him, end quote. Very powerful, very insightful, and a beautiful, beautiful article. As I've said, Hillel Goldberg has a blessed pen, but I consider this piece in Rav Huttner the ultimate achievement of Hillel Goldberg, the ultimate jewel in the crown of his publications. Okay. Now, we went through Rabbi Huttner once on an elementary level. We went through Rabbi Huttner through Hillel Goldberg. I want to devote the rest of my lectures on Rabbi Huttner. It's not going to happen in a minute. It takes time. I want to devote, where do we have primary sources where we can build a world, who Rabbi Huttner was? Is Rakefet right? Is Hillel Goldberg right? Where do we see it up front? And Alex, I want to tell you something. Memoir literature is very, very important. Generally speaking, memoir literature does not lie. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. If I write about the contemporary situation in Israel, I'm writing with my own perspective. And I may be right, I may be wrong. I'm a Mizrachist, and a Gudist would write differently. Eda Chared, the person, would write differently. Torah V'Yavod, the person, would write differently. Because everyone is writing with his perspective. Memoir literature, you're writing what was, how you appreciate it, how you understood it. There's no lie involved. you are really describing how you understood the situation at that time. You're describing the facts of life at that time. Very generally speaking, in writing memoir literature, you do not have a desire to fabricate. You understand? Because you're writing it. If you're writing something 50, 60 years later, all right. You cannot be totally honest. You must have your own partiality, your own prejudice. But if someone is a kid and he's writing as a teenager, a college kid, but he's writing at that moment, you can depend upon him, and at least you know this is the way he understood it. This is the way he characterized the Alta. It's a fact. This was the influence the Alta had him. It's like writing about Lubavitch. When you write as a chassid, so someone can say, well, he's a chassid, what do you expect? But no, on the other hand, this is how the Rebbe influenced him. This is how Chabad influenced him. And this is all this memoir literature that they're interviewing people today about the questions they asked the Rebbe and what the Rebbe answered them. It is precious because they go back to their youth, to their first meeting with the Rebbe. And you see the chief rabbi of the British Empire, Rabbi Sachs, when he talks about what the Rebbe, he would have been a professor at Cambridge, at Harvard, Yale, YU, wherever, in philosophy. He was a genius in general philosophy. Later he develops in Jewish philosophy. But it's all one meeting with the Rebbe when he was a kid, and the Rebbe suggests to him, do something Jewish. I don't need a better example than Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik. With all due respect to Chaim Dalfin and his book, The Rav and the Rebbe, Rav and Rebbe, I think it's called. Interesting volume. Everyone should read it. Everyone should go through the footnotes. But I don't believe the Rav ultimately reached a synthesis between Litvak and Chassid. But there's no question. Alex, you're entitled to your opinion, but the Rebbe's entitled to his.
It's not always about opinions. It's about trying to find out what the truth is.
Yeah, no, I understand, but every truth you see through your own prisma. You understand? And I knew the Rav intimately, and that's my take on the Rav. Yitzchak Rubin knew the Rav intimately. We saw the Litvak. There was a sideshow. But the Litvak was the main show. But anyway, be it as it may, when the Rav tells you about the influence his Chabad Rebbe had upon him, Rabbi Yaakov Riesberg, it's overwhelming. And you see, this is life. This is truth. This can't be falsified. This has nothing to do with what happened 40, 50, 60 years later. It's real. And you can reconstruct the world so beautifully and accurately. Now, the main source we have on the life of Rav Huttner is in the Sefer Zikaron, Le Moran Baal HaPachad Yitzchak. This, if you look at the Pachad Yitzchak and the way it's published, so there's one additional volume called Pachad Yitzchak, but it's Zichronot, Kiddushei Torah, it's collection of published writings, collection of what people heard from him, but the first part, his son-in-law and daughter write a long description of their father's life. Any work that will be written afterwards will have to go back to this description. However, you have to understand that it's not a scholarly work. It's a biography, but a biography where a lot has to be added to it. It's more a anecdotal biography based upon how they knew Rav Huttner and based upon Rav Huttner's writings and particularly his letters. But this biography...
He edited it, or he...
No, Rav Huttner was not alive.
Well, this was published.
It was done by his daughter and son-in-law. His only daughter, Bruria, and his son-in-law, Rav Hillel David.
Yonah's
excuse me?
Yonah's
Yonatan David. I said Hillel David. There's a Hillel David here, Rosh Yeshiva. Yeah. That's the name I constantly refer to. Yonason David and his daughter Bruria, Dr. Bruria Hutna. Now, that biography, someday someone has to come and do a major biography on Rav Hutna, what you call a critical biography, but it doesn't mean negative. It means critical in the sense scientific, with footnotes, with cross-references. And one major topic that a philosopher has to do as part of this biography is the shtanz, or the thrust, of Pachad Yitzchak. Was it entirely new, or was it just a reconfiguration of the thought of the Maral, putting it into the language of Brooklyn of the 50s, 60s, and somewhat of the 70s. You follow? That is a challenge that awaits some enterprising, bright, sincere young man to pick up this challenge and take it further. But I want to show you something beautiful now. Powerful. The greatest influence on Rav Hutna, there's no question about it, was the Alter of Slabodka, Rav Noton Zvi Finkel. His years in Slabodka, afterwards Chevron, that was the influence of his life. Everything else was icing on the cake. But the heart of Rav Hutna, and I'll show you this afterwards too, I'll give you sources down the line. A wonderful volume appeared a number of years ago. You should be familiar with it. Live Torah, Learn Torah, Love Torah, Live Torah. It's about the life of your rabbi, Rav Mordechai Pinchas Teitz, the quintessential rabbi. The volume was written by his daughter, Rivka Blau, married to my chavruta, my classmate, my dear friend, Jerry Blau, known to you as Rav Yosef Blau. Now, right away, a question has to be asked. Can you rely upon a biography written by your daughter? So, of course, you have to take in consideration it's a daughter writing about her father. As someone who wrote about Rabbi Revel and Rabbi Silva, with really not knowing them at all and not ever dreaming when I did my work in Rabbi Revel that I was writing about my own cousin, so the level of these two biographies, I would say, Baruch Hashem, can pass any university standard. It's totally impartial. It's a scholar looking in and recreating the lives of these two great individuals. I could never write a work like that on the Rav because I'm partial. It's my Rebbe. My biography of the Rav, all right, but it's not a full biography. It's a very factual. No one has ever made a correction. Believe me, thousands of people were looking to correct, but the biographical discussion of the Rav stands on its own, but it's only a monograph. And it's not like my work on Revel and Silva. I have to say about Rivka Blau's work, it is a fine scholarly piece of work. Considering the fact that it was written by a daughter, it is accurate, it is fair. Obviously, someone can come along who is not a family member and perhaps do a more critical biography. But this volume is a beautiful, beautiful volume. I will also tell you, and I believe I've mentioned it before over the last decade or so, I made the only correction, the only mistake she made, I caught it. And she thanked me. There'll ever be a second edition. There may be a footnote with the correction thanking yours truly. The correction is very fascinating. Coming back to who rules the roost, the man or the woman. So Rivka writes about her mother, that her mother would fence her father in. And she would tell him at times, don't waste your time on Narishkeit. A Rav's job is to be a Rav, to learn, to paskin shilas, to inspire, to build a community, but don't get involved in Narishkeit. What's Narishkeit? Politics. First election, 1949, during the respite here in Jerusalem from the fighting, what they call in Hebrew the Hafugah. So he started working very hard to unite the Mizrahi and Agudat Yisrael. And Rivka's mother, the Rebbetzin, told Rav Teitz, according to Rivka, Narishkeit, they'll never unite, don't waste your time. And Rivka writes, and my mother was right. I wrote to Rivka, check the history books. In 1949, we had a miracle. For one and only time, Aguda and Mizrahi ran a joint ticket. And they did very well in the election, and they became basic to Ben-Gurion's government. The first minister of social welfare was the Gerer Rebbe's brother-in-law, Rabbi Shemaya Levine, the Gerer Rebbe's brother-in-law. Could you imagine? He's married to, it's unbelievable, first election. Something that could never, ever happen again. In our lifetime, now, impossible. Mizrahi and Aguda have gone so far apart. But if you listen carefully to yesterday's shiur of your humble servant, could very well be in 30, 40 years from now, they'll be running a joint ticket together. It's fascinating, the processes at work in life. You'll understand me when you hear yesterday's shiur, though. Ich red nicht Narishkeit. Ich red nicht in Welter rein, like the Rebbein used to tell us. And beautiful, beautiful volume, but that paragraph, correct. The Rebbetzin may have been right, it's a waste of time in general, but to get involved in politics, but Mizrahi and Aguda ran together. Now, beginning on page 17, Rivka recreates Slabodka as it was exactly around the time when Rav Hutner studied there. Her father, who was, I would say, a drop younger than Rav Hutner, comes a few years later, but it's essentially the same Slabodka.
He was born in 08.
In 08. Rav Hutner, what did we say? He was born, what was it, 1900? One second. He was born in 08. We're in 1906, so two years older. And first of all, Slabodka. How did the Alta behind the scenes, we'll come to Rav Hutner, we're not leaving Rav Hutner, but I just want to give you a feeling of Slabodka. The Alta who Rav Hutner describes was so hidden, and Hillel Goldberg describes, when you came into Slabodka, the Rosh Yeshiva was Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Levush Mordechai, a Lushin graduate. And yet, he said Shayurim, he was Machadesh. But he didn't control the yeshiva, the students. The Alta stood on the side. How did he do it? All right, the Alta was responsible for all the finances. The Levush Mordechai never mixed in to the financial situation. Students were given stipends. What's unique about Slabodka, it's not that everyone was equal. In the Kollel, everyone gets the same stipend. Natan, am I right? Baruch Hashem. Not that they can keep the money, because they have to pay for utilities and they have to buy their own food. It's not that they can save a penny out of the stipend. Just the opposite. But everyone gets the same. Natan has never missed the class that Rakefet gives. If I were running Gris, I'd give him more. You follow me? No, everyone gets the same. In Slabodka, they sought to encourage excellence. The better you were, the greater the stipend. Who controlled the stipends? The Alta. You understand? So the Alta, standing on the side, but He controlled it. Students had to answer to him. He knew exactly what was going on. And if the average student got 10 ruble a week and someone showed godliness and dedication and was a mesnik, he got 15 ruble, etc. Now, there was something else very unique around Slobodka, where you see how they stressed this admiration for excellence. They wanted you to climb the ladder. Sulam mutzavatsa rosho magia hashamayama. And this was unique. As a result of the Soloveitchik family, a tremendous problem developed in the Litvishi Yeshivat. They no longer turned out poskim. For Lushin turned out poskim, you take the briskadayim of Simcha Zelikriga. That's a product of a Lushin. Posek Mufak. Reb Chaim Moshe Rizhensky, we spoke about him yesterday, the Posek Achron of the literature world, he's a product of the Lushin. Reb Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, we have Paskin Denlis Sheilat in his lifetime. He had the Paskin. He's a product of the Lushin. But when Reb Chaim Shita took over the dialectical approach, the ability to see two different trends. But then when someone asks a shaila, you have to give an answer. You can't say, do both. I told you, the greatest mistake I ever made in my years in the rabbi was 1961, 62, when a simple balabas told me his father's yahrzeit is in Adar, and that year there are two Adarim, Adar Aleph, Adar Bet. When should he hold yahrzeit? So I answered him both. You know, if you look into the Achronim, you see it's a homak like this. And they say, if you want to be from, right, you have that problem, Matan. Yeah, you have that problem, Mori. Right? Exactly. And I answered this, Balabas thought I was crazy. What an ignoramus boor. He got to ask a rabbi, a shaila, to hold two yahrzeits. He can hold two yahrzeits. He can answer the shaila. He wanted an answer. Today I would have given him an answer, would have told him, hold the second yahrzeit. Well, hold the first. It's a machlokes achronim. It's not so simple. If you want to be a tzaddik, so hold both your tzaddiks. Does the sehat nish to zagen kaddish tzvei. What Morty does, I can't do. He fasts both your tzaddiks. I told you, when I have a yahrzeit, I make a siyum, my mother, and a minute later, I become a chassid. I make a hilula. I'm a compromise. What can I tell you? A synthesis. But no longer had poskim. The Alt of Slobodka, right after World War I, established a kollel for poskim in Slobodka, so that the best students could study and become not just Rosh Yeshiva, but poskim as well. Now, the greatest example are two names that all of you know, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky and Reb Yaakov Yitzchak Ruderman, are both graduates of the Slobodka Kollel. Our Rebbe of Musa, Reb Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessen, was one of the main fundraisers for this Kollel, greatly supported it, because he already was a shtatrav, and he knew you had to know how to paskin. So you see, this was an innovation that you had in Slobodka that you did not have anywhere else. Stress on greatness, striving, learning, but not just Reb Chaim, not just the Rosh Yeshiva, not just the Chiddush, not just analyzing a Rambam, but in addition, paskening la halacha. And they turned out poskim. She also describes how the students were called, and this is something that went on in all the Litvishi yeshivas, certainly in Slobodka, certainly in Telz, Rotten. No one had a last name. You were known by the city you came from. So Reb Yitzchak Kutner was known as Reb Yitzchak Vasheva. She says this right here. Her father, who was born in a small town, But the closest big city to where her father was born was Riga. So her father was known as Pinchas Rigera. That was her father's name. Now, in addition, part of the scene after World War I, and I'll go into this in great detail, God should spare me a number of years from now. I did a lot of research, a doctorate, but you won't believe it, a doctorate just came out a few years ago here in Israel on the yeshivat in Eastern Europe, in the Litvishi yeshiva during the interbellum period between World War I to World War II. So here we're talking the 1920s. Something amazing also happened. In two World War I, the Litvishi yeshiva, who studied there, who went to Volozhin, 99% were locals. Russia, White Russia, Ukraine, a few Polish students who were not Hasidim, even a few Hasidim wound up in Volozhin. You now had foreigners. And Slabodka, while it never became like Miro tells, you had many Germans and even one American student in the 20s. The Germans, I've explained many times, how did they get involved as a result of World War I? World War I, the Germans conquered Poland, Lithuania, and they were very kind to the Jews. This is why in the memoir literature you read that some Jews stayed behind. So what if the Germans come in? They were very good to us during World War I, and they totally dismissed the idea that they're going to persecute them and kill them and destroy them. They were good. Not only were they good, German soldiers, from soldiers, German chaplains, Rabbanim, the Kalibach family, other families came in and they saw the Polish Jews, they saw the Lithuanian Jews, and they fell in love with their Yiddishkeit. They were no longer satisfied with Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary, Tzikalt, too cold, not emotional. And it became like today, why you boys come to Israel to study in Israel, all right? I hope when they go back, they say, Ein Torah, Ke Torah Derech Israel. But Germans came in, and even in Slabodka, you had Germans. Now, this was very, very good for the yeshiva. Why? Because the Eltera Bachram, many of them needed money. Many of them didn't come from wealthy homes. This is a depressed Eastern Europe financially after World War I. All right, they got a handout from the yeshiva, but it didn't hurt to teach a German youngster who paid him for teaching him. These German youngsters had to make up time, had to make up learning. What did they learn in Germany? I told you, Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary was Chachmat Yisrael, Wissenschaft. You had to get a doctorate from a neighboring university when you got ordination. Now you come into Slabodka, there's a world to make up. It's like today you see a kid came to Israel on the Taglit program. 21 years old, brilliant kid, I think he had a master's already. Didn't know too much about Yiddishkeit. Taglit, what do they call it in English? Taglit, birthright. Taglit, it's really Hebrew, discovery, I think. Is it called discovery? Because Taglit means discovery, you're discovering your roots. This kid became Frum. 10 years later, he got smicha from YU, studied with me in this very kollel a number of years, right or wrong. But he had to make up all that he lost. You get an older chavruta, a litvisha, within a few years, you're up to par. It brought in money. The Germans had money. But who is the American? And this is very fascinating. Rabbi Yitzchok Yochanan Spector, who this man was, Gon Shebegoinim, Avi Agunot, what this man Paskin, look at Rakefet Chelek Gimel, Rakefet Aram about Rabbi Yitzchok Yochanan Spector. Look at Chelik Bet of Rakhafer Aaron, the whole article I published on his 100th yard site. Why he's called the father of Agunat. What a gun. His son, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovich, Mitva Rav, gone out there. Very little remains of the family, if at all, in the Jewish world, in the Torah world. There is specters here in Israel associated with Yad Vashem. I once asked my daughter, who was working in Yad Vashem, I asked my middle daughter, find out if they're related to Rizchokhan, and they ain't a klach, chill, but not from wherever you go. But he had a shamash, his right hand, his secretary. He left 3 volumes memoir literature. Reb Yaakov Lifshitz, very fascinating individual, more right-wing than Reb Chochanan. Some of the statements Reb Chochanan made, he was not happy with, he would alter them. He was, if I can put in today's terminology, Reb Chochanan was a shtickle Mizrachiite, a bit of Mizrachiite. His secretary was a total agudist. So you should know that the secretary's children wind up in America, and his grandson came back from America in the 1920s and studied in Slabatka. And like this was a sign, an Americana, 1920s. It's not the 1930s in Mir, when a quarter of the Mir consisted of Americans and English and South African students and German students, maybe a third of the Mir. This was an Americana in Slabatka. But it starts to give you a feeling what Slabatka was about, what was happening then. Now, Rivka tells a beautiful story with her father, which again conveys the taste, the sweetness of Slabatka. Fellow students come in, the whole atmosphere is one where you not only learn, you think in learning, the way you think, the way you speak, it's a different gestalt. So she tells the story that when her father arrived in Slabatka, he had to rent a room, and he was looking around, and he found a newly painted room that he wanted to rent, but the price was high. All right. He then looked at other rooms, but nothing could compare. Came back, you can imagine, a first-rate treatment, painted, fresh, nice facilities. Came back, and he says to the woman, I love your apartment, but the price is high. Could you give me one more day to decide? And Rivka quotes the answer. She answered, my father, quote, nu, einem mekudeshet, end quote. It's not betrothed. It's not married. In other words, it can wait another day. No one has betrothed. It's not that someone's going to snap away. Right, you follow me? Shem yekadema acher. It's a concept in halacha that you can get engaged during the 9 days that no one else should grab the collar away. Her father was so impressed with the woman that he... A simple woman. She didn't go and learn. There was no Beis Yaakov yet in Slabatka. You follow me? The world was first beginning to change. It's not... it's sat halachot like we have today, and the whole machleik is yes or no. I think it's a fait accompli, but that's my own opinion. I don't have a problem with it, because women can paskin shaylas. When you eat in someone's house, whose hashkacha are you depending upon? And you should know, women had shecht, dakot, and had kabbalah on bedikah, and shechting and doing a bedikah in Italy during the Renaissance. We found actual kabbalah that women received. So, you see, there is a tradition, particularly in Tarat Mishpacha. It's a great thing that a woman can confide an intimate question to a woman. I told you, the Rebbe used to get, Tova told me this, that there would always be in the mailbox a day bedikah wrapped in cellophane, in an envelope, and her father would have to paskin, and the Rebbetzin would call and tell the woman what the story is. You follow? So here you have women, but we're talking simple women. But in Slabodka, even a simple woman who never went to Stern College knew how to speak like a Torah Jew. Says, nu, ain't a mekudeshet, ain't a mureset. It's not betrothed yet. You can wait another day. He took it on the spot. Now, something else about Slabodka, and this already, you start to understand Rav Huttner, and Slabodka was very different, and again, we live in a dream world. We think of Volozhin. Oh, everything was so beautiful, wonderful, no problems there. Oh boy, were there problems. The Haskalah was all over the place, and students were getting Haskalah literature. The Mashkiach's main job in Volozhin was to check the mailboxes, if I can use Matan terminology. Bialik and others were reading Hebrew, Matan Hebrew, the Mapu, others. There's so much was happening. Matan Hebrew literature, the return to Hebrew, science. What a world. Broadened. Jews can go out, even go to university. Don't have to convert. There was a very strong underground in Volozhin. Many left Torah, you're aware of it. Some became big communists ultimately. Many remained in Torah, but broadened. Some remained from, some didn't. It's a bitter battle going on. Haskalah, secular Zionism, socialism, Bundesism, ultimately Bolshevikism, communism.
In Russia, they couldn't get into university, so the smartest ones went to yeshiva.
Well, they went to yeshiva as Bialik came to Volozhin, thinking it was more open than the little yeshiva in his community. But Bialik didn't have smicha, but he was a Talmud Chacham, no two ways about it. But there was a current underneath. And they were fighting the newspapers and fighting the Bichl, as they called them. Slabodka, after World War I, it's not only Slabodka, it was Telz as well, but Slabodka, totally the opposite. By the end of World War I and the Communist Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, anyone who had an IQ over 90 understood that all this Haskalah is going to destroy the world ultimately. And by the way, we're living it today. I don't believe the world, I may not survive. I mean, what's going on with transgender, and a boy's not a boy, a girl's not a girl. I mean, look at the sources, look at the Gemara and Chulin, Daf Tzadi Aleph, Tzadi Bet, Koltvin K'tuv, I don't even want to spell it out, it's sickening, sickening. Look at the New York Times, look what we're living with. So I'm not certain we're going to survive. But by the end of World War I, they knew this. In Slabodka, the author encouraged them to read newspapers. It was a different attitude altogether. You got to know what's going on in the world. You have to know how to refute it. You have to know how to deal with it. You have to know, and this Rivka Blau takes a pot shot at Gurdjieff Yisrael and all that's going on in the modern world. She said that Torah had a different connotation in Slabodka than it has today. Didn't mean that Torah, that rabbis are invisible, that someone gives you a psak and you accept it black and white, you don't question it, someone gives you a hashkafik concept. That Torah meant you should think like a Ben Torah. You, the individual, the student, you should have that Torah, that you don't think like a pushtak, you don't think like the New York Times. And in order to develop that Torah on your individual basis, you got to know what's going on in the world. And this was the altar. After World War I, total different environment, much broader than what a student was up against in Volozhin. And the truth of the matter is that you're going to find percentage-wise much, much less people leaving Torah from the famous yeshivat. From mere, practically none. Slabodka, very, very few. Professor Wolfson, all right. I don't say he left Torah, but a tzaddik had a nishkeven. But a professor at Harvard, but a Jew who identified with the Jewish people, very few. Tells maybe a little bit more than Slabodka, because Tells was more open. They actually introduced secular study under Tells. Tells was like YU. No one in Tells today, if you'll say this, if they're not honest, they'll smack your face. And if they are honest, they will say, yes, your Rebbe's right, that's true, but we can't do it today. Times have changed. Whenever you hear times have changed, you understand what I'm saying. Baruch atot and melech olam shakon yevet v'ro. Times have changed. Das Torah, I quote, he developed in each student the sense that he was unique. My father remembered that he stressed examining a question, not accepting things as they are, making a singular contribution, developing a Torah intelligence, Das Torah, respecting Kavod Adam, Kavod HaBriyah, everyone's honor. Das Torah now means the superior knowledge only a few scholars can possess. But then it meant each student developing his own understanding so that the Torah would guide your life.
Don't forget, that, these are very these are advanced students. These
not the Seder, the Seder. This is the Alter, this is the Saba, this is Slabodka. And finally, now we come to Rav Hutner, and this is beautiful. The Alter, I'm quoting from page 20, the Alter understood the dramatic effect of small gesture. I go back to Bnei Akiva, Camp Moshava, early 50s, Saturday night, Sudash Lishit, Yudavin Mincha, Sudash Lishit, the sun is setting, the room is dark, the lights are not going to go on again till before Havdalah, once there's man, they'll turn on the lights so someone can make Havdalah, give them one light. And they start singing. Not just Smira, not just Mizmor LaDavid. A Nigun. Chabad Nigun. Ben Zion Shenker wasn't on the map yet. Shlomo LeKalbach wasn't on the map, but they were Nigun, Chabad, Ger. Slow Nigun, darkness, wow, it penetrates the soul. Listen to this paragraph. The author understood the dramatic effect of small gestures. He spoke to the students at the end of the third meal on Shabbat as the room was growing dark, when everyone was attentive and every word penetrated the heart as well as the head. In the 1960s, when Rabbi Taitz's son-in-law, I'll put in brackets, Ani Rothkov's Chavruta, end the brackets, Rabbi Yosef Blau, it's her husband she's talking about, described the talk by Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner. Rabbi Taitz said, after you tell me the content of the talk, tell me the style. When Rabbi Blau told him about the students gathered in a darkening room of dusk on Shabbat, Rabbi Kutner suddenly entering, surrounded by students, speaking in a low voice, with everyone leaning forward to listen, repeating phrases three times for dramatic effect. My father cut into my husband's description and said, quote, in the way of the altar, end quote. You follow? He watched the altar, how the altar gave a talk, the small gesture. Wow. That's Rav Hutner. That's Slabodka. You can see was er eingesafft. I don't know how to say that in English. Yitzchak, help me out. Was er eingesafft from Slabodka. Absorbed. Ah, the word. Two pedestrians. You were there. You went to Chaim Berlin.
Yeah, right? I remember it was the Mitzvah Pesach, the last day. So I walked over from where we lived in Canarsie to the Flatbush, and it was dark, and he started to talk, and he ended up saying, "A guten chametz."
A guten chametz. He had that ability. He was a speaker, but it's not just a speaker, a machanek. It enters your heart. What a beautiful description. This was the Alter, this was Slabodka, this was Rav Yitzchak Vasheva. And you see, this is Rav Pinchas Tantz, where he's developing his early roots. He had an older brother who also was had gone to Slabodka 2 years before him, and he's coming from a kleine shtetl, but he's taking in Slabodka. This is Slabodka. And this is Gadlut Adam. You see, this was the Mashgiach. This was the out of Slabodka. It was Gadlut Adam. This is where the Musar movement splits in half, ultimately. It splits in half, I would say, by the third generation. It's a major split. In the second generation, you already found a shadow of the split, an embryo of the split. But you see, Navarik went, Shiflat Adam, who are you, what are you, Agonish, where do you come from, where are you going? They put the man down. All right, they went in, you remember, they asked for vegetables in a pharmacy, in a vegetable store, they asked for aspirins, they should laugh at you. Slabodka was just the opposite. Gadlut Adam. I always have that expression, I don't want a student to tell me current events. I got to know what's going on. Then it says, Rebbe, what happened? I say, what happened? Your job is to know current events. My task is to comment on them. You understand? This is the Alter. This is Slabodka. This, you got to learn how to think. And they were all pictures of Slabodka, the pictures of Rav Hutna in Slabodka. $1 million. Latest clothes, latest style. You wouldn't be seen without a tie. A tie? In Lubavitch, in Satmar, in Rakefet's world, a tie is a disgrace. It's the only item of clothing you wear because you're a Balgaiva. A shirt has a purpose, pants have a purpose, a belt has a purpose. A tie is just to look fancy schmancy with colors. People should come and, what a beautiful tie. More on spend, $49. On beautiful silk ties, unique design. Ah, and Slabodka, they would have bought the $49 ties. And I'll end off, Yitzchak will agree with me. Remember the Mashgiach Rav Lesson? You always saw him covered up down, dressed beautifully, clean, the bekesha, freshly pressed, a tie, covered up down. It was a different world. This was living Slabodka. But I love this with Rav Yitzchak Kutnam, my sidekick, Jerry Blams, describing it to his father-in-law. And his father-in-law cuts him off and says, ah, I know where he got it from. This is the altar of Slabodka. Okay, gentlemen, we're just beginning. We have a world to go. Oh, next week. We'll finish up. Her description of Slabodka is very important. And then what I want to get on to, I have other material, but what I want to get on to is a living description of Rav Hutna by no less a personage. He's going to enter the room and sit with us, and we're going to hear him word by word, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Rav Hutna will come to life. You're starting, you'll grasp, you'll understand who he was. So what did we do today? We finished out very interesting. I love that thought with the lions. Why the lions bit Noach HaTzadik, but it's a good thought in the Satmar Rav, Rav Aaron Kotler. They were the lions of yesteryear. There are no two ways about it. No two ways about it. And that last decade was difficult. The Pachad Yitzchak Kolel, you can go to Har Nof today, you'll see it. It's a nice kolel, nice piece of property, but it's not a dominant institution. It never became what Yeshivat Rabbeinu Chaim Berlin became in New York. Chaim Berlin is a dominant, it's a main institution. It's right, I don't say it's YU, I don't say it's Lakewood, I don't even think it achieves Mir in America, it probably does achieve, because Mir in America suffers from the fact it's in America. Anyone that rises through Mir winds up Mir Yerushalayim and its many sub-branches that exist here. But Chaim Berlin is an institution, no less than Teira Vadas. Okay. So, Baruch Hashem, Rivka Teitz's description. My dear students, first of all, I want to thank everyone for coming. You make the Rebbe younger and wiser. Secondly, next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, very fascinating questions, continuing the fallout of a ger. Is a ger, isn't a ger? Where do you bury them? What happened in Australia in the senior citizens' home? Reb Moshe, Reb Menashe Klein. We still haven't finished this topic of Geirut, but fascinating. But yesterday's shiur was the prime shiur, the jewel in the crown. Next Monday, we pick up exactly where we left off. I want to tell you about a volume that came out that I am so overwhelmed with. This is a young man I remember as a kid of American origins, Rabbi Ari Schwat. Any of you know him? And he's married to my student, Menucha Quint. He wrote a volume, halachic volume, on the role of the Israeli flag and on speaking Hebrew. I have to tell you, you have to see this volume to appreciate it. I learned a great deal from it. What the Israeli flag means with Medrash, with halacha, with many quotes. He quotes me, he quotes the Rav, quotes the Peshul Shechta. Beautiful volume. Speaking Hebrew, the Vayom Moshe, his entire third of the volume is devoted that you're not allowed to use Hebrew in a mundane daily fashion. And he deals with the Sakhmarov Kedat V'Kedin. The volume, it really beautifully done. It was published, he is the archivist in Beit HaRav Kook in the center of town. And it was, you can get the volume there, I'm told. It was published on Michlagdach Akademit Lachinuch Orot Yisrael, published by Orot, evidently in Elkanah, where evidently Ari Schwat teaches, in addition to being the guidance, in addition to being the archivist in Beit Rav Kook. Can you just give me that? Freebies. First of all, the world is shaking. What's going on with the OU and RCA? We spoke about it yesterday. If you go on the websites, your hand will be burned or your eyes will be burned by reading. Pro and con and pro. Here are two copies of the RCA OU dictum regarding women rabbis. Here's an article.
Is this the same thing?
That is more inclusive. Here is an article. That's the RCA tshuva, I believe. Here is an article on if you can daven in a plane or you can daven sitting down. It's from Ami magazine. Fascinating. Halacha lemaisa. I was once on a plane with Rabbi Avadya Yosef and he got so angry with was standing up and walking and this. He walked away from the minyan, sat down and continued davening the chiddush. So,
I was on a plane with Rabbi Erlanger from the Mashgiach from the Yeshiva. So right. I said, sit down.
You'll see the article. I sit and I don't stand up. Because
you can't
forget about that. You can't concentrate because the plane, they're always walking up and down. It can shake. You want to daven with kavanah.
But it's opposite the bathroom usually.
And that also is bad. Okay, here's a very interesting article about the Rebbe and Yemenite Jewry and the Mossad. This is very fascinating. I wrote to the person who sent it to me that I had the same experience. When the Mossad approaches this Yemenite kid and they tell him his name, his background, who his mother was, his father, his schooling, and then they ask him to go to the Rebbe. You have to read the article. It's very interesting. And I had the same experience when the Mossad called me anonymously in May 1980. I write about it in Washington. When the guy tells me who my wife is, who my children are, how old they are, I started shaking. This is all Chabad, unbelievable. They're doing a documentary in Hungary about this anti-Semite who found out he was Jewish and became a Chabadnik. This is about a Chabad chaplain who has a long beard in the American Army. This is about Torah Mesorah at their latest convention. One of the keynote speakers was a Chabadnik. This is from the sixth Rebbe, his trip to America in 28, 29, and how he describes it. He's in Philadelphia. He describes the Jews. Very fascinating. This is Rav Zusha Posner, who goes on Aliyah. The Rebbe makes him a shliach, one of the early shlichim of Chabad. And the Rebbe actually attends the farewell party. And he says, I wasn't such a good student. Why did the Rebbe? But he says, the Rebbe went to Lod. He's been a Chabad shliach in Lod for the last 50, 60 years. Very fascinating. Ah, the Rebbe's insight. Here are two articles on the new book that is coming out that supposedly is on the way to yours truly, on the Rebbe's early years, with pictures here of all the documents they uncovered on the Rebbe. And here is something sad for you, Morty. Remember you said you knew the grandfather of the boy killed in that terrorist attack? This is here. I saved this for you. Did you see it? Do you recognize his grandfather here? Pass this back, the article. And finally, if anyone wants, this is a DVD on a memorial for the Meitzer Te'ili's great-grandson. A young man married to a student of mine, died early 50s, and a beautiful, beautiful memorial with wonderful speakers. I knew him very well as well, but you might want to see it. And until we meet again in health and happiness, I want to wish Professor Eli Rothkopf a pleasant, safe trip back to the United States, where he has many treasures of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And I hope he will wise up and see to it that some of his treasures will come to the treasured land. But I want them to remain, not just to learn, not just to take Peret Haaretz and then take them back and burn them in America. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya. Okay.